You're listening to A Closer Look. I'm Rose Scott.
And I'm Dennis O'Hare. Rose, we've heard for years that the illegal drug trade is not just an urban thing or in quote-unquote certain neighborhoods. That's not news. We know buyers and sellers are busy in the suburbs, too. And it turns out many of the sellers are kids. Scott Jakes and Richard Wright just published a sociological study of why some middle-class suburban kids get into the drug business. The study was done right here in Metro Atlanta. The resulting book is Code of the Suburb: Inside the World of Young Middle-Class Drug Dealers. Scott Jakes joins us now. Welcome. Good to have you.
Thanks for having me.
First of all, I mean, what kind of drugs are we talking about here? These are kids dealing drugs, and just give us the type of drug and the ages that you looked at.
The book focuses on when they're in their high school years, 14, 18, that kind of thing. And mostly these kids were involved in marijuana, but some were in, you know, dabble in other things, ecstasy, LSD, you know, mushrooms, cocaine, and some kind of weird other things that I'd hardly even heard of before I did the study.
But then nobody was doing dealing heroin.
Yeah, it was interesting. Like, we just never saw heroin and we never saw crack cocaine. Those were the two things that for whatever reason didn't come up there.
Now, you based your work on interviews with some 30 young drug dealers, if I counted correctly, and many of these were high school friends of yours. So, full disclosure up front, did you ever deal drugs yourself?
What, did you?
Pardon?
Did you?
No.
No? Well, no. I don't know. See, what the book's really about is those 30 people, so we should probably talk about that.
Okay. All right. Tell us about these kids, and you know, you mentioned ages. Were they all men, mostly men, and were they the kind of kids who didn't get into any other kind of trouble?
It's all relatively speaking. You know, if we're talking about trouble as in serious stuff for the law, a lot of stealing, a burglary, violence, assault, no. I mean, these were your kind of stereotypical, quote-unquote, good kids. Went to school every day, played sports, you know, did music, that kind of sort of stuff. But they got pretty heavily involved in using, you know, marijuana on a daily basis, these other drugs for those who did those on a weekly basis. And selling was a way to support their habits among do other things they wanted to do.
Scott, let's break this down a little bit. Let's talk about who these kids are by demographics. Are we talking mostly Caucasian kids here? You're talking about middle class kids in the suburbs. And I'm assuming most of the buyers were also Caucasian kids?
Yeah. So the dealers, the suppliers, so the people the dealers got their stuff from, and the customers were all the same. They were white, with rare exception, you know, maybe someone was Asian. One of the dealers, for instance, his mother was Asian. They were from a very middle class, you know, idyllic kind of suburban community. Their parents had professional positions, you know, most were college educated, that kind of upbringing, and they all relied on themselves. You know, it's a pretty, you know, well-established fact that if you're buying drugs or you're selling drugs, you're selling them to people like yourselves. You're buying them from people like yourselves.
And they were dealing, I want to be clear on this, were mm-hmm. they dealing in school? I mean, we know they were probably dealing in the neighborhoods. Were they dealing in school as well?
Did they deal in school? Sometimes, but that wasn't usually a good idea, and they mostly refrained from doing so, because where do you have a lot of people looking out for people doing things they shouldn't be doing? Yeah, in school. You know, there's more parents there than anywhere else, more teachers there than anywhere else. So usually what they would do is they would sell out of, for instance, the grocery store parking lot, or maybe out of the basement of their friend's house, things like that.
And this was considered, I'm assuming, underground, because the good kids weren't supposed to be involved in this, so this sort of had an underground.
I mean, you know, anything where there's a consequence of getting caught is, you know, underground in the sense. But on the other hand, it was in plain sight if you knew to look for it. You know, part of the reason they would, for instance, sell out of a grocery store parking lot is they show up, and why are people in parking lots? Well, to buy groceries, of course. But at the same time, they know that, and so they use that space to go there and say, we're not going to attract attention because there's a reasonable reason to be here. We get in, we get out, and we move on with whatever else we're doing.
But they have to store the drugs someplace. You said in some cases they were selling out of the basement of their house, so the obvious question is, where were the parents? And what did they have to say about that?
Yeah, you know, it's not that simple. I don't know. Maybe if you remember what it was like to be a teenager, if you have parents that are of that age, you know, you can have a loving family where people mostly stay on their own. You know, in the houses we're talking about, every kid had a bedroom. At most, they split a bedroom with their brother. They were afforded a certain degree of privacy, and so long as they were otherwise doing what was expected of them, their parents gave them that privacy. They had, you know, their own vehicles, although usually their parents bought them. Their parents weren't really invested in going in and searching that vehicle every day. Again, especially if the kid's doing well in school and doing well in sports and all that. It was the kind of thing that I'm not sure they even realized what was going on, even, you know, because there weren't a lot of outward signs. Let me put it that way.
And you mentioned some of the reasons why they got into dealing in the first place, as opposed to just, say, being a recreational marijuana user. Money obviously jumps to mind right away, but what were the other reasons that they gave you for why they got into dealing particularly?
Yeah, the money thing, to speak to that real quick, is interesting because they weren't in large part getting into dealing to make money. It was really a money-saving venture where they're spending $50 a week on an eighth of marijuana. And, you know, when you're 15, 16 years old, $50 is a lot, especially if you got to pay for your gas and restaurants and you got a girlfriend or whatever it may be. And so $50, you finally figure out, well, if I just buy a quantity of marijuana or whatever drug and then sell everything but what I want to use to my friends, well, I'm not actually spending any money per se. Beyond that, the other two things were, one, they referred to it as extra money. And extra money is important because, you know, unlike, for instance, the dealers that are operating these really disadvantaged areas, their kitchen was stocked. They had all the clothes they needed. You know, I already mentioned a lot of their parents were buying them vehicles, giving them credit cards to put miscellaneous expenses on, things of that nature. And so they wanted, though, extra money. And extra money, I'm not sure if I can curse, so I'll just avoid it. But basically, they referred to this as, you know, the S word, stuff they really wanted but really didn't need. I'm sure stuff like adults go out and buy and, you know, those kinds of items that they display. Hey, I'm cool. You know, I know what to buy. I know what to wear. You know, at the time, maybe Abercrombie and Fitch was a really big thing. And then the third thing is, and I think this partially relates to maybe a general propensity, or maybe it was just seeing what their parents did. You'd go to dinner with a group of parents, and the parents would fight over who paid the bill. And when these youngsters got into dealing, they would come into a certain amount of money, and they would use that money to buy their friends burgers, or to take people to the movies, or, you know, later on, once they went on to college, buy them beers at the bar, that kind of stuff. So it was all about having the drugs, because the drugs were really at the center of their kind of social network. What these kids did was drugs. They, you know, they didn't really go to the ice cream parlor or anything like that. They didn't go to dances. They drove around a lot or went to houses and consumed recreational substances. And so it was related to affording that, extra money for all the other things they wanted, and then just giving their friends essentially a good time on their own bill.
We're speaking with Scott Jakes. He's the co-author of Code of the Suburbs, Inside the World of Young Middle-Class Drug Dealers. Scott, let's just be really honest here. I mean, someone listening might say, you know what, it sounds like a bunch of middle-class spoiled kids who think they're cool, so they're going to sell drugs. Did you have to promise them that names would be changed? Because you went to some of your friends and you said, hey, I'm going to put this book together. I want you all to tell me stories. I mean, what did you have to promise them? Because somebody's mother may be listening, saying, my son or daughter went to school with Scott Jakes, and right. I need to know some information here.
Well, I mean, the first statement you made was absolutely correct. So leaving that aside, this kind of research that I did is very common, okay? You know, these studies have been done with robbers. Right, exactly. Robbers, burglars, you know, carjackers, just violent retaliators in general. Other people have studied drug dealers, you know, usually inner city stuff. And maybe it's a somewhat different circumstance in that, yeah, I say in the book, these are my friends and, you know, friends of friends. But it wasn't like I only had 30 friends and friends of friends, you know. And I think that would be the key. If I was talking to any of the dealers right now and their mom's about to call them up on the phone and say, hey, weren't you friends with Scott Jakes? I would say, yeah, I was, but that wasn't me. And, you know, that's really all it comes down to, that plausible deniability. And I should reiterate, there was a lot of drug dealers. You know, I once went through the high school yearbook, and by my count, about 5 out of every 100 kids had sold drugs at one point or another. So it's not a rare event.
This is described as a sociological study. Is it any other reason why you and Richard wanted to put this book together?
You know, why we get interested in things we get interested in really isn't that clear to me. But it was just a story that struck me as you know, people know about it, but they don't know a whole heck of a lot about it. You know, they see it in their family and they feel awful about it, or they get caught and they feel awful about it. And for good reason, they should. But on the other hand, people don't share those stories for the same reason that they feel bad about it. It's stigmatizing. It says certain things about who you are, or maybe what your parents did or didn't do. Whether or not that's true in fact is a different issue. And so it's kind of a hidden thing that, again, everyone knows about. And I just wanted to shed some light on that.
And no one was ever caught of your friends?
No, that's not true. So there was two exceptions of, well, just as a bit of, you know, the 30 people, only two were ever arrested. And they are interesting cases in that they actually didn't happen in the suburbs. Both were, one of the dealers was coming back from a party town further out in rural Georgia, happened to get caught in that area. Same kind of thing with the other dealer, actually going down to spring break, finds himself in rural Georgia, probably speeding, not a good idea. And I think those police are well aware of what's probably going through their area and don't take too kindly to it. And that was the problem.
So it's interesting, and you should say, that the two who got caught were not in the area that you studied. So did they have the feeling, at least, that there was some kind of maybe tacit understanding with law enforcement that if they didn't do anything violent, law enforcement wouldn't really rouse itself to stop them from dealing because they had other things to do?
It's not really that well thought out on the part of the dealers. You know, the dealers on the one hand...
How did they look at that?
Yeah, it's tricky because on the one hand, they were very worried about getting caught. But on the other hand, because they knew the consequences were quite serious. On the other hand, they didn't think they were going to get caught. And when they did come to that point, and, you know, most of them did in the end, that was for them the sign that, oh yeah, I really need to get out. So, you know, several dealers said something along the lines of, if I keep doing this and I keep doing this, bad luck's going to happen. You know, you get pulled over for something arbitrary, you know, you run through a red, whatever it may be, and so my time's running out. I better stop, you know, kind of while I'm ahead.
But they're also dealing, occasionally, one would think, with pretty dangerous people. You got to get the drugs from somewhere. But one part of the code that you talk about that might seem different from the stereotype of drug dealers is these young men seem to go out of their way to avoid violence, even if they had been robbed, attacked, beaten up, whatever. Yeah. Why was that?
Yeah, so to kind of get back to your earlier question, dealers would say things off the cuff like, oh, well, you know, if you start getting violent, well, what might happen is the police get involved. Okay, I beat someone up, that kid goes home, his mom is worried, calls the police, all of a sudden everyone knows I'm a drug dealer. But there was a more basic issue at hand, and these people had grew up in a very safe environment.
The code is different.
Yeah,
the code
is totally
different in the suburbs than it is in the inner city.
They didn't grow up needing to defend themselves. You know, maybe their bicycle was stolen. But other than that, they could go about their day-to-day life and not worry about whether people were afraid of them or not, which is a very different circumstance. And when they became when they came into drug dealing, it's not like all of a sudden they changed and said, oh, well, I'm in drug dealing. Now I better start defending myself of violence, carry a gun. They had the same outlook. They were just selling drugs. And
So this wasn't Breaking Bad.
This was, well, you know, there's some funny scenes from that where Jesse... what happens to Jesse is one of his, you know, dealers that's working for him gets robbed. And so, you know, Walt and Jesse have this discussion in the middle of nowhere. And Walt's like, what are you going to do about it? And Jesse's like, I'm not going to do anything about it.
And these were your folks, too.
Yeah, and it was the same kind of things. Like, you know, one asked a rhetorical question after some money had been stolen from his car. It's like, what am I going to do about it? Shoot him? No. I'm just going to either do nothing, I'll maybe stop talking to him. I might, depending on the circumstance, call him up and try to ask for him to give me my stuff back. But the idea of getting violent, you know, they said a lot of interesting things too, like, I literally, you know, and this is in quotes, I can't imagine being violent. I can't imagine punching someone in the face. And that's a very different orientation to conflict management than, you know, what we see in the stereotypical movies and media images of drug dealers.
Well, and, you know, some of that stuff actually happened, so you know, I can imagine that for some of these kids, if they were really dealing drugs in other neighborhoods, it wouldn't be as peachy.
They
as
wouldn't
out in the
deal
suburbs.
Drugs in other places
and
in the first place
would,
because
no.
They'd realize really bad things were about to happen to them.
Right. You give the suburban Atlanta town a fictional name, Scott Peachville, but you give a little identifying information too, which hints that it might be Snailville.
The book did this in a way that I think's very crafty, where you could read the book and come to that conclusion and you would be wrong. And that doesn't mean you're not right in some ways, but it's a little more specific in different ways where you can't pinpoint it as such. And, you know, that was a fine line here. And we walked it, and, you know, on the one hand, everything we say about the area is true, but on the other hand, we don't call it out in very specific ways like that.
Why not just tell it like it is? If there are areas of that you know of, you know, because you were not part of it, but you were immersed in it as a student, why not just tell the facts? I mean, maybe some parents or people would like to know.
Yeah, the more important issue.
We all know about the bluff.
Right,
you know?
No. The more important issue isn't, is it Snellville or is it Lawrenceville or
why,
is it
why not?
Marietta? Well, because the more important issue is this has happened in all those places. You can write down any suburban city in Atlanta, and it's going to have exactly the same stuff going on, I bet. Or you can carry that on to any other metropolitan area in the United States. It doesn't matter what city it is. This is a story of 30 dealers, but on the other hand, it's a story of people that are involved in this all over the place.
And for many of these dealers at the end, I mean, you mentioned how few of them eventually got caught. It seems that there weren't the kinds of consequences that a drug dealer in the Bluff might face. And do you think there's a difference in the way that our culture, and did they even see it that way, a difference in how they were perceived versus how somebody from a different socioeconomic background might be perceived who was also dealing drugs?
You know, it's hard to say on the one hand because it's not a study of what the police did and what they, you know, it's not from the perspective of the police or the courts or the judges and why they do
the
things.
Yeah, but they clearly, the dealers clearly had to feel, look, I'm not going to get caught. You said that yourself. So did they think about why they felt that way?
The dealers in their own mind, you know, and it could be, and it probably is far more complicated than this, in their own mind, they didn't get caught because they took precautions not to get caught. For instance, they would, you know, they would follow the rules of the road when they were driving around with a lot of quantity on them. They would choose very particular places, as I referred to earlier, that they perceived as safe. They were, you know, they weren't selling to anyone. They were choosing friends of friends, people who they assumed wouldn't snitch and were certain weren't undercover cops. So if you, when they explain why didn't they get caught, those are the reasons. It doesn't have to do with being white, you know, middle class, suburban, although those things in a broader way, I'm sure, probably play in.
And some of them left, and I guess all of them eventually left, and are now holding jobs and becoming part of suburbia. Is that part of the code?
There's always, you know, one or two in the bunch that, you know, haven't achieved conventional success. But by and large, you know, these people went on to get college educations, and they have professional positions, and you know, are starting families, getting married, doing all those kinds of things that, again, if you looked at them today, you wouldn't look at that individual. And, of course, you didn't look at them back then like this either, but you wouldn't look at them and say, oh, that's a drug dealer.
The book is Code of the Suburb, Inside the World of Young Middle-Class Drug Dealers. Scott Jakes is the co-author along with Richard Wright. Scott, thanks for coming in and taking the time. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
It's a fascinating book. Thanks so much.